Michael Meets is a podcast interviewing regular people about life, work, their interests and aspirations. Apologies for this episode being a week late, but work got in the way this past few weeks and at the end of the day, it has to come first. But I will try and stick to releasing a new episode each fortnight. The website is currently under development and should be ready soon, where you will be able to find extra information on items referred to in each podcast, like photographs, newspaper clippings, web links and stuff like that. I have to warn you that in this podcast there is the odd swear word, but it comes from me in reacting to some of the stories that this week's guest shares. The year was 1974, the year that the transition year was introduced for the first time in Ireland in three pilot schools. Northern Ireland ground to a halt as the Ulster Workers' Council called a strike following the defeat of an anti-Sunningdale Agreement motion. The smoking gun tape of the Watergate saga is released, in which US President Richard M. Nixon and White House Chief of Staff discuss using the CIA to block the FBI inquiry. BBC One first aired the children's television series Bagpuss, and topping the charts that year was Tiger Feet by Mudd. It was also the year that Stephen Murray was born in the city of Dublin.
The year I was born was an interesting one. The year I was born, my paternal grandparents died within 6 months of each other. And my mother's brother was found with just his hand sticking out of a pile of rubble from a wall that fell on him and killed him. So the year I was born, three members of my family were. Also, and the year before that, the year my mum got married, the year I was born, my illegitimate half-brother was also born. Yes, so there's loads of scandal and loads of drama.
Not long after Stephen was born, his family moved to London, but his parents' relationship didn't last. His mother took him and his sister to go live in the Shelter for Battered Women, founded by Erin Prizzi, later to become Women's Aid. During the time at the shelter, Stephen and his mum met a woman called Sheila, who then became his babysitter. After a few months, they moved out and his mother met a new man called Aladdin, who had a brother called Sinbad. Like Stephen said, you can't make this shit up. I'll let him continue the story on from here.
In fact, my earliest memory is of my sister being born and me having to walk and having sore legs. That's my first memory. I can remember the Palm Court Hotel vaguely. Do you know what I mean? You have those memories, they're like Polaroid memories, aren't they? They're like sepia.
You had to walk your sore legs, what's that memory?
That memory is just like, I just remember Jenny had the pram. And I've been so used to being pushed around and I was getting a bit too big to be carried.
Oh, right.
So I'd have to, no, you've got to walk.
Sorry.
And there was no man to carry me, you know, because Aladdin, look, was mum's husband or boyfriend at the time, but he wasn't carrying kids. He was younger than her, 21-year-old Egyptian man, handsome, worked in a nightclub, but he wasn't carrying her kids. Like, he just wasn't doing it. You know, and that's a story actually about my mum when I was about three, my mum coming down the stairs where she'd left Jenny sleeping in her cot, and she came back and there she saw Jenny asleep on the bottom step, and she came down and there was me, three, fast asleep in the cot. I lifted her up and climbed in. I remember one Christmas, right? Listen to this. I remember one Christmas. When I found out that Christmas, Christopher Michael came up to me outside the school in Orleans Park School. He said, "Have you heard?" I said, "How's Santa?" I said, "What? Is he dead?" He went, "Worse." "What? It's a coma." He went, "No. Apparently he's not real." I was like, "What do you mean apparently?" I said, "Well, get your presents." And he was like, "People are saying it's your parents." And I went, "Yeah, prick. My mother, the bitch." Because I remember one day, that's not fair, remember. I remember one day, we asked for stereos for Christmas. Mum bought us stereos, neither of them worked. Next Christmas, she bought us Gladys Knight and the Pips and Cassette and Chaz and Dave. And I was like seven. I was eight and Jenny was seven. And Jenny got Gladys Knight and the Pips, and I got Chaz and Dave. And I remember Mum coming out and catching us going, she said, she said, "But we've been really good all year. I asked him for a dollhouse and you asked him for scale electrics and he got us, we didn't ask for this." "No, we must have been really good, Jen, but it must have been that time. Do you remember we took the pear drops out of the jar and we weren't supposed to, and I counted them?" It was like, But that was, but we got punished for that, and we were like trying to reason why we got these presents for Christmas. And then Mum came in and went, "He's let you down again, hasn't he? He's let you down. Santa's a prick. Santa the prick." And I, after leaving him out all the cake, and he drank all the wine and all the beer we left him, and then she'd fall asleep. And Aladdin then would get up at like 1:30 in the afternoon of Christmas,
yeah,
and he'd cook some exotic, you know, Middle Eastern brunch with, you know, with fava beans and loads of cumin, and it smelled nothing like sage or Christmas. My mum would be passed out, and Aladdin would put on but the turkey would be in the oven, and then Aladdin would put on some mosque music. Nothing like Jingle Bells,
yeah,
you know, and then he'd come in and sit in and watch the news, and we wanted to, you know, on the other side of the chitty chitty bang bang, you know, like, you know,
yeah.
And then Mum would get up and the turkey would be burnt. Now, in fairness, my mum is one of the best cooks I've ever tasted in my life. She is a talented woman, you know. Mum was a drinker, you know, and, you know, like, Allah wasn't, because he was, you know. And he was also quite an independent young man. And Mum's drinking got kind of worse. Their marriage started to disintegrate a bit. Then it totally fell apart. And Mum was, you know, like, Mum, she was never really good, and still isn't, with boys.
Mm.
You know, like, she's good with little girls. She's never really liked, you know. You know, she's never, not liked, because she loves deeply, but she has no tolerance for little boys. And she also was quite a temper on her and was quite violent herself, you know. So... You know, so it was still quite a violent household, you know.
Mm.
Like, and then Anna left, and so it was just her and her drinking, kind of, like, you know, I suppose that, look, what Anna had was some kind of order in the house, but once he left, it was just drink.
Right.
And it became quite a violent household. And then one day she was throwing punches, and I just slapped, punches isn't fair, slapped. I just grabbed her wrists, and I was 13, I was stronger than her.
Mm.
And that was a massive changing point.
Sometimes people come into your life for a reason. At the Battered Wives shelter, Sheila befriended Stephen and his family and became their babysitter. After I finished recording, I wonder a few times now, does she know this next statement that Stephen makes?
I mean, she's definitely the first one I was ever in love with, but I was 4, she was 19. You know, it was never going to work. But it was perfect as well.
And how do you know you were in love with her, Laura?
Oh, I just remember, you know, the way a 4-year-old is, you know, like, it just... Because, well, she loved us so much, and she was 19, and she was in love with us, me and my sister, and you could just feel it burning from her, you know. She just, like, you know, and, like, you know, and I remember when she got married, actually, and myself and my sister were both page boy and bridesmaid at her wedding, big affair up in Scotland somewhere, and I just remember saying, okay, I'm going to live in Scotland now. And I remember how sad it was for all of us.
Yeah.
And I can still remember poignantly how hard that must have been to say, I'm going away, you know, but you'll still see me. You know, and she went off, and, you know, she had her own. She was, like, you know, one of the most beautiful people I've ever known in my life.
Sheila's family were well connected. Her father was a local news anchor, and with those connections brought many of opportunity for Stephen, one of which was meeting Cliff Richard.
I just met him around this time. He had that song Wired for Sound.
Yeah.
And just because Sheila, our babysitter, they knew them. They just knew them. They were kind of like these, kind of like, I suppose, upper middle class English salt of the earth. Like, they were just the salt, you know. I mean, they just, like, some of my most golden memories of my childhood. But I remember, we were kids. We were all, Cliff Richard was number one. We were all impressed by him roller skating around, singing Wired for Sound. And they said, listen, we know him. We can take you to see him. So they take us to things like Billy Smart's Christmas Circus, which was live on TV.
Yeah.
You know, like, and we were there at it live, you know. We could get, like, FA Cup finals. We could get tickets for whatever we wanted, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and yeah, so we got to meet Cliff Richard. It was brief. And I'll never forget, actually. My mum came up with something really funny around that time, because she used to drink with this woman. She'd made friends with a woman around the corner. And she worked for these two guys, two gay guys in a restaurant. Should I even say their names? Hans and James, yeah, I will. And one day she explained to me what gay was, you know. And she said, you know, like, it means when two men love each other like a man and a woman. So I was like, about 5 or sound, 6 maybe sound. So, like, so then she said, I'm with Cliff Richard. And I came back and said, Mom, is Cliff Richard gay? She went, no, no, love, he's a born again Christian. I said, what's a born again Christian? She said, means he's gay for God's son.
What were you like as a teenager?
You know, I became angry. I became furious. I became a very difficult teenager. You know, and just things broke down. And I ran away one day when I was 12, about 12 and a half. And I went to my auntie Sheila's in Wales, who lived up in the valleys and the mountains in Wales. And she was always like a mother to me. Her husband, Sean, was always like a dad to me. In fact, he's probably the reason I'm a poet and why I played rugby.
Mm.
Put a rugby ball in my hand when I was six. Put a book of William Blake poems in my hand when I was about seven.
Yeah.
And taught me how to build shelters and catapults and bow and arrows and fish and stuff like that, you know. So I ran away straight to them. If they could afford it to have me, I would have stayed there. But they couldn't, so the social workers were called, and we had regular social work visits, but the family unit kept breaking down, so I was in foster care a bit. And then one day, she just called and said, take him away.
Right.
So I went to live in the children's home.
What was that like?
So it was cool, if I'm honest about it. It was great. Serious? Yeah, it was brilliant. Brilliant. I mean, the day that it happened was mad. It was like, because, you know, foster care is grand. It's like, it's not ideal, but home was horrible. Home was like, you know, home was a disgrace. In fact, do you know what, interestingly enough, I often think that with all the talk of suicide that goes around now, thank God it wasn't around then.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? In many ways, the awareness that's around now, if I'd been aware of all that.
Aware of that suicide option,
I might have taken it. But arriving at the children's home, like, you know, it was like when we had this social worker, Bernie, and we loved him. He came every week, he had a marijuana leaf on the back of his Citroen 2CV special. He listened to Velvet Underground and Nico. He wore bangles and he had flamboyant spectacles and long hair and paisley shirts and flares. I thought he was the coolest thing ever. But the one day Mum was sober every day was the day he came. It was the only day she was sober. And she stayed sober for his visit. She was immaculate. As soon as she was gone, you'd hear the twist of the and the glug glug of the martini going back in. Yeah. And he was just like, listen, your mum is not an alcoholic, man. And then on this one day when she came out, it was his last day on our case. And we were all a bit upset about it. And she kind of got drunk before, had a few drinks before. He'd never seen her drunk. She made a lunge for me in the meeting. And they just said, take him away. It was kind of like a bit of a, I think he was going to take me away anyway, when right. He saw that. And I said, are we going to foster care? I was in the thing, and he said, no. He said, that's not an option anymore. We're going to go to a children's home. And I just thought, oh, no. Because my mother always kind of said to me growing up, like, you keep it, you know, she obviously said, you keep it up, and one day they come and they'll take you away to a home for naughty boys.
Yeah.
So that was like six or seven, and then at 13, there I was, off to the home for naughty boys, like, you know. I arrived there and it was grand. I mean, like, whatever. We had a pool table. We could smoke. You got pocket money. The residential social workers were really lovely. They were kind. If you wanted a sandwich, you can go and make a sandwich. Well, I wouldn't have made a sandwich. I got the wooden spoon. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, I think when I arrived there, I had a sense of how lucky I was because a lot of these kids in there were fucked.
Mm.
You know, some of them have been like, some of them have been written by their parents, like, you know, there was some serious shit going on. So whatever my mum did wrong, she did a lot right, because I arrived in that children's home. There was a little bit of violence at first. There was a couple of nasty lads in there, but I kind of rose to the occasion and went medieval on their asses. And I did something quite vicious one night, and there was a girl living in there, and she said, you just can't take it. You gotta do something. You gotta show that you're not gonna take it. So I did something quite nasty to one of them, and that was it. No one fucked with me again, and I became the alpha male of the place pretty quickly.
Mm.
In the space of about 3 weeks. Yeah, I kind of had the run of the place. I could watch whatever I wanted on telly. I remember one of the residential social workers, Andy, going, oh, mate, what's a kid like you doing in here? Because I was winning poetry competitions. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, like, and I was really good at school. You know, but like, I was getting away with shit as well, because I was the kid at school that, you know, I was the one that everyone said, Stephen's having problems at home. You know, I was that kid, the one that everyone gets told, you know, don't be, bear in mind he's having problems at home, so I want everyone to, you know, I'd always be called to the principal's office so a teacher could have a word with the class and say, listen, just everyone be a bit kind to him and gentle to him. So then I befriended a fella called Andrew, like, who was Greek Cypriot Londoner. And you know, like, we were on a skiing trip. We went on a skiing trip to Italy. And on the coach back, he and I were sat beside each other, and he was like, I heard about your children's home thing. You're a children's home. I was like, yeah, yeah. What's it like? That's grand. Like, you know. So he was from a divorced family. We got talking about our own divorced, you know, our own dads and, you know, our lack of. And next year, as we started hanging out, I started going around to his house, and his mum said, like, one day, what the bloody hell is that nice boy doing in a children's home? He can't have that. Why don't you come and live with us? So that was that one put in motion. So I went to go and live with them. Or will they actually, because what would happen normally was you'd be processed through the system. When you were 16, you'd be housed in the housing estate, like flats on your own. You'd have 16 with your own apartment.
Your own flat,
but you'd be in a dodgy estate now, you know, like, you know, so, like, so, and you'd be, you know, like, as a result, I mean, like, obviously, the only male of that crop of a children's home that didn't go to prison. And I went to live with Andrew's family, and that was great. I started learning to cook Greek food. Like, I kind of moved in around 15, and then at 16 it was official. Well, I lived with them for a year and a half. It's quite a sad story, actually, this one, because while I was living there, like, you know, like, my dad got back in touch on the 1st of January, New Year's Day, 1992. We would have been 17 now, it would have been the year of our 18th birthdays. And I didn't want to talk to an angry young man. I'm not talking to that fucker, you know. And Andrew had been like, you should maybe give him a chance. Like, you know, so it was going to be Andrew's birthday on the 22nd of February. It was his 18th. We were onto our jazz funk. We used to go up and see into jazz club, 17, you know.
Yeah.
Dressing in suits and rubbing newspaper around our jaw to look like stubble and smoking cigars. And, you know, like, you know, and, like, you know, wearing sheepskin coats and stuff. Like, you know, wearing middle-aged outfits, and we followed the brand new heavies, and we went to all their gigs at the town and country club and stuff, and, you know, and I went to the 100 Club and Ronnie Scott's and places like that, and they were playing the Brighton Jazz Bops, and then they were playing in town and country on Saturday, so we got tickets to go to the Jazz Bop, and then tickets to go to the town and country club on the Saturday, at the beginning of February, I was always broke anyway because I was shit with money, still am. But Andrew said, listen, we'll just go and see your dad. So I changed my mind, said, okay, I'll go and see my dad. My sister was gone. So they got me a flight, and I was supposed to go to the Brighton Jazz Bop. And so I said, okay, give my ticket to someone else. So Jamie, one of the legends, was gone, gave it to his girlfriend. I came back, met the Murrays, met my dad, fell in love with them all. And on the Saturday, I was due to come back. It was my cousin Al, who's one of my best friends now. It was his, it would have been his 22nd birthday. So I said, well, listen, I'll pay for your flight back. You stay an extra day and come out for my birthday. I said, I've got to get back for Andrew's 18th. I've got to get back. So 2 weeks earlier, we'd been out drinking at the local tennis club. And we were all there. Like, and I was a bit of a bad influence. It was another lad, Ben, was a bad influence as well. And two of us were bad influences. And we were in this thing. Some of the lads had to get back from Chiswick to the other side of Southwest London, and I'd found these car keys, and I said, "Why don't we just rob this car? Find out the car and rob it." So we weren't looking for cars. We passed the police coming raiding the party on the way in, and we said, "Hello, police, hello, officer, or police office," and tried all the doors. Next thing, we came to this door that it fit, so we opened this old Cortina door, and. Ben opened the thing up, the door up, and it wedged against the pavement, and he basically, he came up kicking to get down. Next thing, we're trying the keys, but it's not starting. It's the wrong key. Next thing, out of nowhere comes this big knuckle the size of a bull, and I've got to get out of the car, and it's got this knuckle in my face, going full of sovereign rings, going, "You fucking move, I'll break your nose." And there was two big burly builders. Well, get a gun, Pete. So he gets a could have been any gun, it was probably an air rifle. Ah. Next thing, he's got a gun going, "Go and get the police, keep guard stuff." I'm sitting in the car going, "Listen, lads, he's not going to arrest us. He's not going to shoot us. Yeah. Kids, it's probably an air rifle. After three, let's go. One, two, three." So after three, I just legged it out. I saw your man cocked the gun, aimed the gun at me. I don't know if he took a shot or not. I kept running and kept running and kept running. I was on my own. The lads got arrested.
Yeah.
I was arrested later that night. Like, we were waiting to see if we were going to be charged with attempted theft of a car. We were all squeaky clean. We had no criminal records at all. And so when I came back from Ireland, having met my family and fallen in love to celebrate Andrew's 18th, I saw a police car outside the house and thought, oh, no, I just found out about the fucking charges. We were waiting to see if we were going to be charged or not. So I arrived at the door and I heard this wailing. I thought, fucking hell, it's not that bad.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Fucking settled down. So I went in, as I went in, Andrew's, one of Andrew's godmothers said, he's been killed, you know, so. So I was like, okay, and I immediately snapped into, right, okay, there's people coming around for his 18th.
Mm.
I better make calls. So I was calling up Dano and one of the lads, and next thing, Andrew's sister came up and said, they've all been killed. There's like five of them were in a car crash and all five of them had been killed that morning. I waited outside. Actually, Zoe's best friend was the actress Kate Beckinsale.
Right.
And our family were outside, you know, and I just left the house. I was like, I just bawled crying, like, you know. And like, you know, and then I went back in and just mum said, you're the only son I've got left now, Stephen. That was it. I was just like, I remember when she said that, I was like, I'm going back to Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It was like the guilt of being the son that came in,
yeah,
from a place of not really having that much self-esteem and or sense of self-worth.
Mm.
You know, like it was like, you know, I'm not going to replace him.
Yeah,
and also a lot of guilt that I wasn't in the car, a lot of guilt that it was not me and not him. So I moved back to Ireland 6 months later, and I went to live with my dad, who said, "Come and live in my penthouse in Clontarf." So I moved back to Ireland and I was sharing a bed sit with my dad in Fairview. Yeah. Actually, I kissed Kate Beckinsale at Andrew's funeral.
Did you really?
Yeah, I kissed her. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Wake or?
Was that? No, in the limo on the way to the burial, on the way to the church.
So how'd that come about?
Well, she was beautiful, obviously. She wasn't famous then, but she was always going to be famous. She was around the house every day, so she was, you know, she would have known Andrew years, you know. Mm. And just her and I were waiting in the limo, and she just reached over and pulled me in and gave me a big old smooch and went, "It's those boyish Irish good looks. I just can't resist them." But I was like, I was exotic to her. I was like an Irish orphan. Do you know what I mean? It was, yeah, like, you know, I was like this. I was a bit of rough,
yeah,
you know, like. And it was after the Joshua Tree, so the Irish were starting to be sexy in London. Yeah. You know, like we were becoming fashionable. Like, you know, I'm getting a hard ride in this. My mum is a brilliant, brilliant woman, you know. We had our problems growing up, but she is a great woman. You know, there's no doubt about it. But
what are the things that make her a great woman, then?
Charisma. You know, she makes a lot of people happy.
Yeah.
You know, she makes a lot of people happy. I think, as is common in quite a lot of Irish families, quite a lot of Irish people make the world happy, but not their own. I think this country represents that.
Mm.
The world loves Ireland. Like, we treat everyone else, the Irish treat everyone else brilliantly. We're so kind to strangers, but we're pricks to each other.
Mm.
I remember working on a building site in London. We were working with for these Scots Presbyterians from Glasgow, and one of them said, "Hey, Mitch, check out Paddy there. If it weren't for the fucking wheelbarrow, the island should still be on all fours," which I thought was brilliant. And me and this guy, Willie from Wicklow, he was in his 60s, roared laughing. And I said to him, we started talking, "Man, how we end up working for these fuckers? We got on great, and the banter was brilliant." But he said, "It's better than working for an Irishman." I was like, on the tinted glass on about Irish. "Sure, I'd love to work for an Irishman." He said, "Never worked for an Irishman." So I says, "An Irishman will fuck his own." So he won't fuck an Englishman, because an Englishman won't take it.
Yeah.
But he knows an Irishman will take it. And I think you can see that culture. A lot of families are like that, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Except in England, you had the space for it to fall apart.
Yeah.
In Ireland, with the Catholic Church and the regime and the way things are, the institutions, they say protect the family, they protect the abusive family as well,
mm.
You know?
So Stephen moved back in with his father.
And it was always a battle to see who got to sleep first, because the other one wouldn't, because the other's snoring.
Aye.
And you know, I think I started to discover my dad. It was a complicated character, charming. Mm. In many ways, in a lot of ways, a better parent.
Mm.
He's very paternal, but kind of kind of monstrous as well, like, you know, like, yeah. He's got this monstrous side to him, but, like, you know, came in with a sneaker kill a couple of times, and, you know, so moving back to Dublin then, I moved back to Dublin at the time of the commitments, and I was leaving Dublin, London, of drum and bass. Mm. I'm friends with DJs, and, you know, like, it was London of trip-hop and funk and disco and the best club scene in the world that was coming back to Dublin of the commitments.
You weren't impressed?
I was not impressed at all, do you know what I mean? It was like, you know, so I went back to London then a year and a half later. And I played rugby at quite a high standard, you know, like, but gave it up fairly fast. My best mate became the biggest male model in the world.
Who's that?
Gerard Smith is his name.
Yeah?
Yeah, he was like, you know, the face of 96. He was on, you know, he was the face of Hugo Boss and Gucci. He was all over buses around the world, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I started selling timeshare for a company called the Paradise Club. So then I was like hanging out with Gerard and going off to the Paris Fashion Week and, you know, like, MTV parties, and he was going out at one stage with Kylie Minogue's flatmate, so I met Kylie at her flat in Cadogan Gardens around the time she made the thing with Nick Cave when her career had been on a slump, just mm-hmm. before it came back when she made The Wild Rose, and we were sitting in the party but arrived early. I was off my head on some speed pills. And she had a shaved head, big tits, I remember, tie-dye top. I'll never forget that, because I didn't even recognise her.
Kylie did?
Yeah, she did, yeah. Yeah, we're talking mid to late 90s. And again, she wouldn't have been, she had a completely shaved head at the time. And she came over to me, and I was saying, and she was like, I think it's going to get really hot in here. And I was like, yeah, and I started chatting away, and next thing I realised I was chatting to her, and I started choking on my own tongue. Spitting gibberish, you know, like, she just kind of threw me a scornful look and walked off. I was probably 20, 21, I was a really angry man, I would have said. You know, you wouldn't have known it to me.
You wouldn't know that now either.
Yeah, I don't think you would have known it back then either, but, like, as soon as the fight kicked off, I kind of enjoyed it.
Right.
I just, you know, I came from violence, it was like,
yeah.
And it was kind of, you know, and I had this, you know, like, I kept really fit and, you know, and I boxed a bit, and, you know, and it was just a case of, like, I think it was a bit of a children's home mentality.
Mm.
You know, when the children's home, I was doing press-ups every day and shadow boxing in my room. Mm. And it was just to, like, you know, you just kept at your fittest and toughest.
Yeah,
you know, to survive. Yeah, but to maintain. Yeah. Like, because I remember, like, when I was looking, like, you know, like, alpha at children's home, it would have been, like, you know, and Fatima was really the alpha. I wasn't really, but, you know, but, you know, like, be fellas coming and be like much bigger than me, and like and I'd just be alpha them because they were scared of me,
mm.
and they could have killed me, you know. Yeah. Like, you know, I just knew how to intimidate them,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and not that I was an intimidating person, but just, you know, like, and they loved me in the children's home as well because I kept all the kids off solvents,
right?
You know, so
I had that from about like.
Just wasn't really into it. I took Tippex dinner one night. That was fun, but I still had, whatever my mum had done wrong, when I arrived at that children's home, I did not feel like I was one of them.
Mm.
I felt I looked after them, but I did not feel like I belonged there, you know. I'd no interest in doing, you know, sniffing glue or taking heroin, you know, or anything like that, you know. Or, you know,
yeah.
Like, I'd kind of felt like there was just levels I would not go below.
Yeah.
You know, so my mum, actually, the children's home gave me a big sense of what my mother did right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, massive sense of, like, you know, of the values it instilled in me,
yeah.
that would never be compromised.
Compared to what the other kids had?
The other kids didn't have those, yeah, yeah, you know. Yeah. Spent 3.5 years working between college and work, going to college, dropping out of college, doing college but not turning up to college, then selling times over the phone, then getting sacked from various jobs, working on building sites. Things got a bit dodgy, I got quite into drugs. Kind of became homeless, was hanging out with a very dodgy guy, sleeping in cars, breaking into houses to sleep and stuff,
yeah.
Staying with crackheads and smackheads, and, you know, and it was very much, just before I moved back to Ireland, life was very much on the edge,
mm-hmm.
You know, there was a lot of, like, you know.
How long were you homeless for?
Only about 6 months, never on the streets though.
All right.
You know, the worst was in a friend's car.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, and I had people I could have stayed with, but they'd be getting sick of it, you know.
There was another important Sheila in Stephen's life, and that was his aunt Sheila in Wales.
I was there, my cousin Hugh was 16, 15, And he was drinking at weekends, and I was like 22, 21. And there was me drinking with these 15-year-olds going, oh my God, what are we doing in Wales? Like, you know. And there was smoking fucking pencil shavings and shit, like, you know.
Yeah.
And so my auntie got me a job after a while doing window cleaning sales over the phone, booking appointments for window cleaning salesmen. And I did 2 days' work, and I was the best in the office. I got more appointments than the rest of the office combined in the first 2 days. And they said, look, we want to give you a full-time position as a full-time rep. We think you're brilliant. We're going to send you for training. You're going to be on 22 grand a year plus commission, and you'll have a company car. So I was like, okay, great. So you're going to go to Birmingham next week. And I just remember going, fucking hell. If I do that, I'm going to be 22, 21, whatever age it was, 22, actually 22, 23. I'm going to be making a lot of money in Wales, which was poor. Mm. So I'm going to be rich in Wales, which will mean I'll probably stay in Wales, which I couldn't bear the thought of, you know. Love my auntie and you know, my uncle, but like, so one night we had a big row, and my auntie, she'd have thought I'd taken whiskey, which I hadn't. And it was always a trigger for me. When I was accused of doing something I didn't, I'd lose the temper.
Yeah.
I still had a bad temper. And I stormed out of the house one night, the next day, my uncle Sean said, look, okay, you don't do that. People looked after you. And then he was right.
Yeah.
So he gave me a fiver and dropped me on the M4 and I hitched back. I arrived back in London with £5 in my pocket. Bumped into a girl when I got there. Like, I called the girls and said, listen, don't be homeless. Jody, I bought a futon offer. And we got on a couple of dates, but nothing happened. So I called her and she was away. But her flatmate answered the phone, said, listen, she's away back this week. Come and stay. So I stayed with them. And also, I got a gig. I've been asked to do a gig. Because I've been getting up reading poems when I was drunk. And I got a gig at the Bearcat Comedy Club opening. I'd never performed in front of a crowd like that before in my life. When I arrived, I shit myself. I started drinking loads. And by the time I got up, I was so drunk. At one stage, I remember, like, it went down amazingly, the gig. And once came up to me and said, oh, mate, I love that gag you did with the bottle and the microphone. So I said, you know, when he started, like, talking into, like, the mic, he started talking into a beer bottle, and then, like, as if he were fucked, he started trying to drink out of the microphone. And I was like, that wasn't actually a gag. I was just so hammered I did that, like, you know. And it went really well. And literally, I got loads and loads of gigs.
Yeah.
And until a better and better venue started going out with a girl, Janina. You know, I was working, got a job on a building site, till eventually I was MC at this bar called Cabaret. And first night there went down really well. It was like a real celeb hangout. It was like a chance of maybe making it.
Mm.
You know, of getting something, going into a different level. First night I went down really well. Second night I arrived and there was a big scandal because Camilla Parker Bowles' son, the previous week when I was MC, had sold a bag of cocaine to a News of the World journalist.
I remember that.
Yeah, okay. And so that I was MC that night. Yeah. And it was called Cabaret Nightclub, and it was owned by Ben Parker Bowles, who would have been her nephew. So I arrived up and, like, there was celebrities there and everything, and it was, the whole vibe was bad because of this thing going through and people getting chucked out for coke and all the guys going, look, mate, you can't chuck people out for coke. This is a high-class venue. Like, and I just got up and I cracked a joke and I got booed off stage. I said, so, yeah, we've got loads of different acts on. First we've got Blood of the Dead, Blood of the Dead, Blood of the Dead, and then for a final act, Stephen Hawkins is going to come and get his cock out. I was 22, 23, and I got booed off stage, and every time I got off stage, they hated me. Yeah. They hated me for the rest of the night. Went back to Dan's house later that night, and one of his flatmates was a stripper, and there was lots of people taking drugs and stuff, and, you know, and next thing I was in this room, and the stripper come back with loads of other strippers, and there was a couple of couples in there, and I got told, so I said, would you don't mind leaving? Yeah, we just don't know you. You know, it's like, so the next day, so I left that room, like, slept in a bed. I didn't know whose it was. Left early in the morning, slept on a bench in Regent's Park, did a fart and shit myself. And the funny thing was, the next day, Dan called and said, yeah, it's not good last night. Like, come here, were you in that orgy last night? And I was like, what orgy? He was like, apparently it was a massive orgy when the strippers came back. And I was like, no. So I got booed off stage. Asked to leave an orgy, and then I went and sat on a bench and shit myself. It was the ultimate humiliation, so I decided, right, I'm moving back to Ireland. moved back to Limerick, moved back in with my dad again. He was living in Castle Troy, and again I was living there. I was a week living with him, and I went out drinking with my cousin Kev in Limerick, and I came back and my dad was waiting for me. So where the fuck have you been? I was a damn 23, man. It doesn't, you know. So I don't give a fuck. And he's got a snook. He's screwing to get out of the snooker queue. And I said, listen, Dad, I'm not going to entertain this. And, you know, and so like, next thing he comes towards you, the snooker queue. And he says, you'll finally take a swing at me, the snooker queue. And I just caught the snooker queue in my head, kind of like, just burst him open.
Yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden, I'm looking at myself and I'm covered in my dad's blood. So I walked down, and so left there, my dad had to go to hospital. Like, you know, funny enough, my sister moved. My dad always had a turn like that, you know.
Yeah.
My dad put on this drama about he's got to have 42 stitches, and he had to have about four.
Yeah.
You know, he got a nick above his eye, and he bled a lot, you know. So moved back to Limerick, lived about 4 years, four wild years there.
Mm.
But I was still suffering from a lot of, you know, I was still quite a wounded animal, do you know what I mean, from the past. It was still wild, and I had some great years in Limerick, living above Baker Place. My cousin's band got contracted. They were on the verge of becoming very big. They were, you know, they were signed to the Cranberries management, and, you know, so, and I was coming back, it was English Steve, you know, and we go, oh, your man's nice, isn't he? Who, the James Bondy one? Yes, the James Bondy. I heard a friend of mine tell me that, and also I'd never really been confident with girls, and I arrived back in Limerick, and all of a sudden I was very popular.
Yeah.
I was an exotic, cool guy, you know, like, and I had come from, you know, all my friends were pretty cool in London, they came from a very cool London scene.
Yeah.
And so I used a few years of rock and roll in Limerick.
And there's plenty of Limerick people who went to London and then come back.
Loads. And in actual fact, I mean, that's why I have one of my affinities with Limerick is that, you know, like on my mother's side, the Gerrardy side, I was going back to Kildare, I suppose, maybe 15, 20 times a year up until the age of about 7 when my grandfather died.
Mm.
And then it was like 6 times a year. And then when the family unit broke down, it just didn't happen at all.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I didn't come back for 7 years, which was something, you know, like on London, I'd never been home.
Yeah.
And then when I came over at 17, all of a sudden I was coming back every month to Limerick. And then I moved back, and then I moved to Dublin after 4 years. And even for the first 2 years in Dublin, I was going back to Limerick every 2 weeks.
Right.
You know, and in Kildare, all the Gerrardys on my mother's side had fled the nest all over the world. But in Limerick, all the Murrays were there.
Yeah.
The whole family were there. It was there. You know, so it was very much a sense of, this is who I am and this is where I'm from.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because we were known, our family were known, it was a city.
Yeah.
So, you know, stuff was expected of you. You know, like, oh, you're like your father, you're like your uncle.
Mm.
You know, like, people would tell you, typical Murray. You know, So even though, like you said, I mean, I'm a bit of a hybrid from everywhere. I still have a soft spot for Limerick.
I remember, like, your first poem, like, the first thing that kicked you off.
Yeah, like, I can only remember one line from it. I had a teacher called Mr. Spark, Michael Spark, and I think he was gay, in hindsight. My mum said, we were talking about him, my mum, she was on. He was gay, and I was like I wouldn't. But now I look back, like he was this wonderful, posh English, tall English, kind of John Cleese kind of guy, you know. And he introduced us to Charles Dickens and wrote us A Christmas Carol, which I read recently. It's brilliant. And I say Charles Dickens, and then the Angelus comes on. So he basically said, he set us a task of writing a poem about it. So I wrote this poem, Marley's Ghost. The only line I can remember of it is, thump a footstep, hammer on a nail, Marley's ghost appears. But I wrote that when I was 8.
Right.
And I've been teaching that age group this week, and like I was thinking about it, going, wow, if I saw that from one of these. Right. And I remember Mr. Spark, when he got angry, he was terrifying.
Yeah.
But most of the time, he was just really funny. But, you know, look, you just didn't fuck with him, because he was just, you know, like, and he's just like, whoa, puppet, how dare you do this? And he saw that I was really upset. And I said, but I did write it. And he saw me get really angry, but I did write it.
Mm.
And then he just kind of knelt down and put his hands on my shoulders and went, but it's brilliant, boy. And then when I arrived in secondary school, you know, bigger school, keeping it low, not really imposing your personality,
yeah,
not really wanting to, no confidence really, you know. We read A Christmas Carol again, and I was 11 now, and my secondary school teacher, my English teacher, said a task to write a poem, and I just re-entered that one.
Mm.
And she entered it for a competition, and it came runner-up of the whole country, and then my English teachers got on my back and was like, you got to write poetry, keep writing poetry,
mm.
keep writing it. At 17, I stopped writing it. I started writing it about 15. I wrote one poem at 17. I used to tell people, yeah, I wrote poems. Well, I was quite good, you know. And then in an office in London, in a job that where I had loads of space to do what I want, which was nothing. You know, I had loads of responsibility, which I didn't have the responsibility to handle. So I used to sit upstairs and write poems, you know. And
get paid for it.
Just that?
And get paid for it.
And get paid for it, yeah. Yeah, my job was sales. Well, I was responsible for the income of the company.
Yeah.
And so I used to get up and like and just start reciting poetry in pubs. Eventually, I got my own night on Richmond Hill, called Culture Jam. And actually, I remember people would just come and play. I'd be the MC and do poems in between. And it was a packed out night. It was, you know. And I remember this one time, this guy came up and said, "Yes, my daughter. Yeah, I'm a manager. Yeah, do you mind like?" She comes and plays a big set, so she came and played a big set, and she was like, she was brilliant singer-songwriter, but she played all Alanis Morissette's. She says, she plays mainly Alanis Morissette style and some covers, and she turned up to play anyway. She got up and she put the guitar around her neck. She was about 22, and she got up and she like had her left, and then she took her right hand off. No, she was playing her set, she was playing her right hand, and then half of the set she took her right hand off and started plucking with the bone that was sticking out of the stump, which was like the most freaky thing I've ever seen again. So plucking guitar, no plectrum, because no hand.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so plucking with the bone of her stump. And then she was like, oh no, she's not going to sing it. She's going for it. And she went for that Alanis where it says something. I got one hand in my pocket and the other one smoking a cigarette. It was the most surreal thing you've ever seen in your life. Moved to Galway. And in Galway was a place where you were like, if you were a poet, you were a poet. And people, oh, you're a poet. Tell us a poem.
Mm.
And so next thing, you were Steve the Poet. And there was a really vibrant poetry scene in Galway. I'd made the decision. I was in Dublin. When I moved to Dublin, I'd got a job in advertising, not on the sexy side, not writing ads, but selling space in toilets, really unsexy. A friend of mine, Dahi, who's a brilliant artist, said to me, "Don't mind your company card and your credit card. Give it all up. Move to Connemara with me, Simon the Dole, and write."
Because
that was always the thing that was niggling at me. So 29, I did. And I gave myself 5 years to make a living out of it. So if not, I'll go back into marketing and stuff. In 2005, so it would have been 35, 2004. 2004, I won the Kurtz Poetry Slam, the prize of which was to go to Chicago and perform at the Green Mill, where Poetry Slam was born. It used to be Al Capone's speakeasy. It was used in The Untouchables and loads of movies. So I won that, and that set me off then. All of a sudden, then I was getting gigs around the world, and you know, and it was just the inspiration I needed.
How is it working with teenagers in Ireland today?
I love it.
About poetry, like?
Yeah, well, they hate poetry. I mean, like, I have a real problem with where public funding is going in chiefly Poetry Ireland, you know, because I walk into schools, I have it on two levels. Number one is I walk into schools and ask kids who likes poetry, and not one of them puts their hand up. I say, who hates it? And there's a big show of hands in 60% of schools, they hate it. There's 250,000 a year being spent on poetry and education by Poetry Ireland. Where's it going? Why is it not working? That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, I have the most effective poetry schools programme in the country. They should be working with me, using my strategies. You know, we should be, if it was in the interest of the art, they would be, but they're not. You know, I'm sending four people to perform in Atlanta on HBO's Brave New Voices Slam. Not only was there no funding, I'm pretty sure there's not much funding. I didn't even get a share. They didn't even share our social media PR. They didn't even get that kind of fund support. So So, but then I think that poetry in Ireland is something that always looked at the past, wrote the poets that have been dead 80 years and never looked at. It's a great tragedy of poets, like, you know, like is that it's an underground art form, and they only celebrate it, you know. Since my first book was released in 2010, and my first book was, like, I've only been invited to one Irish literature festival, and I've been widely considered one of the best performers of my work in the country. I've been provided to plenty in England, the US, Denmark, you know, Austria, Czech Republic, but none in Ireland. I just think it's because in Ireland the scene is a little bit like, you know.
Was it a big thing when the president became the president? Because he was sold as the president who's a poet.
Yeah, and like, I actually had a little row with a waitress in a cafe, actually. He was digging in, having a go at him over the water charges. I was like, get over yourself. Do not go with Michael D.
Yeah.
You know, like, and a lot of people have been having digs at him.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I mean, and it's typically Irish. Before Michael D became president, he was a legend because of his YouTube clips.
Yeah.
Calling people wankers on American television for their bigoted views. Then he became the president and people started attacking his poetry, attacking his role with the water, signing off the water charges. You know, typically when someone's up there, we want to take him down, isn't it?
Yeah, you know,
we're big fans of the downtrodden.
Yeah.
But my friend Dahi was telling me, he was at a wedding in Limerick, and he was talking to somebody, he said, come here, Dahi, I hear you made a horror film, did you? Fair play to you. I said, yeah. He said, you were sitting around, we got the script, next thing we started going into business, we raised $250,000, and, you know, things went really well, we got a really good deal. I said, sure, you're too fucking good to talk to the rest of us now, aren't you? And walked off.
You've talked about, like, you know, being a kid, you know, a lot of tragedy or, lonely, I don't know if it was loneliness or heartbreak or not a regular childhood, and an outsider looking in, to me, that's the emotions that would bring into my
head, of course.
But sitting in front of me is someone who's quite positive, lots of energy, funny, you know, an open person, like an open book. How do you think you became that person rather than the miserable old?
Well, I think I've always had a sense of immense luck. So when I went to a children's home, I became very aware of how lucky I was to not be them.
Right.
However bad my situation might have been. Sure, childhood was lonely. Children's home was not. Okay. Children's home was a positive thing for me, you know. For my sister. My sister stayed at home. Yeah. You know, I think she got the brunt of the, you know, so. So I became aware of the fact that I hadn't, whatever what I'd come from was not as hard as what most of them had come from.
Mm-hmm.
I came, you know, in fact, what I came from was pretty light compared to them, and also what I had. Then also growing up as well, I became very aware as well that some of the attributes that I have, you know, some of the character traits, when I look at friends and family who have been through divorces or whatever in their family, and it's really damaged them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been kind of aware that there's some kind of manner that I have. You know, so it's easy to be positive when you look at how other people handle their experiences and you look back at yourself and go, no, I'm not without my flaws. I can dip. I've had my mental health issues. You know, I mean, I control them. You know, like, you know, the 20s were so dysfunctional.
Mm.
You know, I think they are for a lot of people. Like, I've always had very good people in my life. Andrew's family were an unbelievable influence. My own family as well, extended family, uncles, aunts, you know. I've always had amazing friends, you know, like amazing cousins, you know. And I've always had good, like, you know, like, people around me to strive to be like and to strive to be nothing like.
Yeah.
So I looked at certain people in my life and gone, right, I want to be nothing like him. Like, you know, so, and certainly there were things in, like, looking at the, you know, our parental dysfunction that myself and my sister grew up with, there were things that we would have been terrified of growing up like.
Mm.
And I just remember being at my sister's one Christmas recently, and she's a clinical psychologist, and it was Christmas Eve, and we were sitting up drinking gin and tonics, having a cry and a hug, as you do after gin and tonics on Christmas Eve with your sister. And, like, you know, like, when Irish kids get to, family get together, we we just go for it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? We go for it, like, you know. And I was just looking at the stack of presents, going, Jesus, look at that. I realised that's Jenny.
Do you believe in God or faith or?
No, not really. No, I am. We were Christian Catholics. Moved to England. Mum married an Arab. Sent me to Protestant Sunday school.
Yeah.
Everyone was telling me the other one was going to hell. Like, I suppose I'd like to believe in something. I believe in prayer. You know, as a power of manifestation of some kind. I believe in a higher power than myself. Whether I believe it listens to me, maybe I do in the same way that our body listens to the prayers of our nervous system.
Mm.
Maybe our consciousness is part of a greater thing. I hope so. Yeah. It's, you know, I'd like to think we go somewhere after death. But at the same time as well, I'm not afraid of death.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Afraid of missing the next season of Game of Thrones. Well, if I just want to find out what happens to Jon Snow, that's all.
If any of your distant or future relatives stumble across this, have you any advice you'd give them about life or anything you'd want to tell them?
Yeah, do you know what I'd tell them actually? If there's one thing that I regret most of all is like that it took me to my 30s to realise my potential. And I think a lot of that was down to the fact that there was never anyone there to to just kneel down to when I was a kid with their hands on my shoulders and go, look, you can be whoever you want to be. You can do whatever you are beautiful and you are brilliant and the world really is yours to bend at your will. As a result of that, like, you know, like when I moved back to Ireland, when I came back to the Murrays in 1982, I was going to do fine art at college. That's what I wanted to do. And they told me, I should have fine arts. That's what they said. No money in that. Go on and do business studies. I went to do business studies and I dropped out and then went into sales and marketing. And there's a thing on YouTube by Alan Watts, if money was no object, I'd say my advice would be, you can do anything you want to do.
Yeah.
Find out what you enjoy doing the most. What are you passionate about? And do it and pursue it.
Yeah.
You know, relentlessly. You know.
Yeah.
And be kind and be heroic wherever you can. Because if you're kind, because kindness is heroic.
So what about the future, Stephen?
So I want to starting a summer school for creative arts for kids. Next summer. Ultimately, I want to be making money from my writing. I've written a children's book, which I'm currently getting illustrated, and I've written a novel, which was going to be published this year. I'm glad it wasn't, because it wasn't finished, but it's about all the stories that you've heard and the much better ones that I've left out. Yeah, actually, no. I mean, actually, you've got the juicy bones of it. But yeah. But there's, you know, you can get much more into 95,000 words than you can into an hour of talking. But it's called, it's a work of fiction loosely based on the events of my life.
Mm.
And it's called The Firstborn Bastard of a Battered Wife. And it will be published and it will be famous, despite all the rejection letters I'm getting now.
They say in life things come in threes. Well, Stephen now has a third Sheila in his life, and if you ever meet him in person, I'll let him tell you about her. Many thanks to Stephen for giving up his time and sharing his story with sincerity, openness, and especially the laughter. It made what sounds like an horrific story more bearable, but also a life well lived, and I look forward to reading The Firstborn Bastard of a Battered Wife. Also, thanks to you, the listener. I've really enjoyed getting your feedback online, via text, or in person. It's great to hear that you too believe that the lives of regular people are more interesting than all the shit we hear and see about celebrities. You can join the conversation over on Facebook, facebook.com/MichaelMeets. And if you do enjoy the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast, because by doing so, you help this podcast get more listeners. Until next time.